Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program, hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and by Wonderfest, the Bay Area Beacon of Science. I'm Tucker Hyatt, director of Wonderfest. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jana Levin, author of Black Hole Blues and Other Songs from Outer Space. Dr. Levin is professor of physics and astronomy at Barnard College of Columbia University. She received her BA in physics and astronomy from Barnard, and her PhD in physics from MIT. Dr. Levin has worked at UC Berkeley's Center for Particle Astrophysics and at Cambridge University's Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics. Before returning to New York, she was the first scientist in residence at Oxford's Ruskin School of Fine Art and Drawing, and she wrote a series of essays to accompany exhibitions at several galleries in England. Professor Levin is a Guggenheim Fellow, and she serves as the Director of Sciences at Pioneer Works, a center for arts and sciences in Brooklyn. She has written two other popular books, How the Universe Got Its Spots, and the novel A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines, which earned her the Penn Bingham Fellowship for Writers and was a runner-up for the Penn Hemingway Award. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Jana Levin.
Right, you heard this. So on February 11th, the announcement was made that this obscure experiment that nobody had ever heard of, but which cost $1 billion, was comprised of two massive instruments on different coasts, each one spanning 4 kilometers, and a team of 1,000 internationally, had procured the first recordings of a gravitational wave sound coming from a distant part of the universe. And what they detected was the collision of two black holes 1.3 billion years ago, and that gravitational wave sound was on its way here ever since. And it seemed as though, when the press announced it, it seemed as though this experiment simply switched on and miraculously had this incredible event. So I'm curious, of those of you who heard of the announcement, which it seems like all of you, how many felt that they understood what the hell it was all about, like an hour later? Okay, nobody. Excellent. Perfect. So what I'd like to do tonight is spend some time talking to you and also with Tucker about why this was so significant and what it really means, and to try to tease that out. So I am a theoretical physicist. I work very much pen on paper, and I do a lot of calculations that have to do with how black holes orbit each other and the behavior of black holes and dynamics. So anything having to do with black holes is pretty much interesting to me these days. And I intended to write a book about that, about black holes. Theoretically, what are they? How do we know they exist? Where do they come from? And I was really just using LIGO as a motivator for LIGO, this instrument that made this detection, as a motivator for discussing these very theoretical things. And I started to kind of pal around with my experimentalist friends. And this can be a big divide, theorists and experimentalists. Like, nobody lets me anywhere near a laboratory, usually. I've been known to ruin boiling water pretty effectively. So I started kind of palling around and thinking, you know, I've never been to the LIGO sites. This is crazy. I want to go see the instruments. And I became so enamored of what they were doing. I was so floored by the scale of the instruments and the complexity of the endeavor and the physicality of it, you know, the reality of it. They were building things out of laser and glass and metal, and they had wrenches. And this thing was going to work. It was going to do something that I had only theorized about, and to some extent, I don't know if I took it as seriously as they did, right? I could see it on pen and paper, but I do a lot of things on pen and paper. I also work on whether or not the universe has extraspatial dimensions, so, you know, my connection to reality is thin, you know? So a lot of it was sort of all on equal footing. It's math. It's what I can do on the page, but these guys were building something. And by guys, I don't just mean boys, of course. There's a lot of women on the team. I'm speaking colloquially. And I started to pal around with Ray Weiss, who was one of the original architects of this instrument. Ray, who started dreaming about LIGO as a young professor in the late 60s while at MIT. This experiment not only wasn't just turned on and succeeded, it was a 50-year arduous endeavor that cost people a lot along the road. And the book very much follows the campaign, like a climbing Mount Everest story. And there's a lot of people who don't make it to the summit, who started this campaign, whose careers were lost along the way, and people who didn't live to see the success of this experiment. But Ray is still out in the trenches. He's at the sites all the time. He's in his 80s now, and I can't tell you how many times somebody said to me, "We better ask Ray. You know, we don't know what to do. We better ask Ray." And so the book took a totally different turn. I ended up writing a completely different book, much more novelistic, where the characters actually have voices, and to write about this incredible campaign. The amazing thing is that when Ray first started thinking about this, there were still many people in the community who weren't even sure gravitational waves were real. They weren't even sure black holes existed. The astrophysics community was by and large, the vast majority was against this endeavor. Ray was building this tiny little prototype in his lab called the Plywood Palace, which was this ramshackle structure that was thrown up on the MIT campus during the war to promote research in radar and microwave engineering and these sorts of things. And his instrument couldn't even detect, as one of his colleagues criticized, if the sun blew up. Okay, and they used to say things to him like, "We'd do better looking out the window," you know. And so Ray had this frustration that this was this dream of his. So what was it that he was trying to detect? The amazing thing is that if you think about everything we know about astronomy, everything we know about the universe, you know, these glorious pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope, galaxies, collections of hundreds of billions of stars on the furthest reaches of the universe, quasars and jets and all of this amazing, fascinating stuff, all of it ticking back 14 billion years, roughly, and stretching about 92 billion light years across in the vast cosmos that we have, all of it comes to us through light. This is how we know the universe. Since Galileo first pointed a telescope at the sky, we've been taking pictures of the sky. It's kind of a silent movie that we've assembled. The farther away we look, the deeper into the past we're looking, because it takes the light time to get to us. And we see X-rays and gamma rays and all these different kinds of light, but it's all light. The amazing thing is that we know that 95% of the universe is dark. It emits no light. It reflects no light. So most of the universe is really darkness. And things like black holes are completely dark objects. We have very little hope of seeing them with telescopes. We see them indirectly. Now we believe they exist because we can see them tearing apart a neighboring star or pulling things into orbit or creating jets. And that's all crucial. But it's a tiny, tiny fraction of the black holes out there. Most black holes out there are dark. And LIGO is an example, a rare example, of an attempt to observe the universe in complete darkness with no light. What LIGO does is it measures ripples literally in the shape of space and time, waves in the shape of space and time. So if we think about what LIGO detected, this first detection, two black holes orbiting each other. One was 29 times the mass of the sun. One was about 35 times the mass of the sun. They were orbiting each other in the final fraction of what might have been a very, very long life together. But only in the final fraction was the event powerful enough for us to detect. They're orbiting each other near the speed of light, about a fifth the speed of light, and then they collide. And if you think of them as mallets on a drum, where space-time is the drum, literally the shape of space and time rings around these mallets. So the shape and the motion of these mallets bang the drum differently. And for decades, theorists have been trying to predict what sounds the ringing drum would make. Now, you can imagine a drum ringing And we can start to argue, is it really making a sound? If you could record the shape of a drum ringing, even in the absence of air, you could play it back as sound. And this is a lot like how an electric guitar works. You think of how an electric guitar works, you pluck the guitar string. Technically, it really does not make a sound. It doesn't move the air. But the body of the guitar records the shape of the string and plays it through an amplifier. In a sense, LIGO's like a musical instrument. It's like the body of the guitar. And it's recording the ringing shape of space-time. In this case, it's not just a string, it's the whole three-dimensional space-time that can ring. And by recording this ringing shape of space-time, they literally play the sound through an amplifier in the control room. You sit in this control room, this sort of big, bright room with monitors everywhere. It kind of looks like they're examining a patient on the monitors. And they do have to wear blue scrubs, actually, because of the clean room. They need to be clean. And so they do look like doctors sometimes wandering around this lab. And they listen to the detector in the control room, and it sort of whooshes all the time, hoping to hear something loud enough that LIGO can record. So Ray is thinking about these gravitational waves, and here's what he dreams up. He says, imagine space-time is ringing, literally squeezing and stretching. We'd be squeezed slightly and stretched slightly. This is happening in this room. It's just incredibly weak from most sources because gravity is so weak, so we don't really notice it. But Ray said, imagine I put mirrors just floating in space. These mirrors would sort of bob on the wave like something bobbing in the ocean. And he said, if I created an L-shaped instrument and kept track of the location of the mirrors, I could record the ringing of the shape of space. And he called it a haiku. He said, you'd think nobody'd ever be interested in it. It was nothing, you know? Then he spends the next 50 years trying to make this a reality. Here he is in his lab. It's the early 70s. He's got this small instrument. It's like an L-shaped instrument with mirrors, little tiny mirrors hanging at the corners of the L, and a laser is shining down, and it's about 1.5 meters wide. Every time the subway passes, the thing falls out of alignment. You know, trucks drive by Vassar Street. Sometimes in this old building, entire windows would blow out and go down the street. And, you know, he realized this can't detect the sun blowing up. It's not big enough. The gravitational waves are so weak, they ring space so weakly that the mirrors don't even notice that the wave has passed. And he begins to realize, working along with Kip Thorne, who's an iconic astrophysicist, most famous to some people because he wrote the original treatment for Interstellar, but more famous to us for all of his work in astrophysics, they began to think more seriously about this, and Ray realizes it can't be 1.5 meters, it can't be 30 meters or even 40 meters. It has to be kilometers and many kilometers. And he begins to realize that what he's talking about is an instrument for hundreds of millions of dollars, that the one that they originally designed is 4 kilometers long in each direction. There is now one built in Louisiana 50 years later and one in Hanford, Washington. $1 billion later and 1,000 more people joined the team. And they built the first instruments in 2000, and they could detect those first instruments, the difference between the mirrors being at 4 kilometers or them bobbing on a gravitational wave so subtle that they had only moved by 1/1000th of the width of a proton. And still the instrument wasn't sensitive enough. There were no detections. So anyone who thinks this just switched on and suddenly succeeded has to understand how arduous this was. 15 years later, they install the advanced components. I'm now writing this book, and I'm in lockstep with them because I've thrown away my original book, and I've started writing this other story about Ray and Kip and Ron Drever, one of the other original experimentalists. And Ray says to me in August of 2015, he says, if we don't detect black holes, this thing is a failure. Meanwhile, the whole scientific community is not necessarily behind them. There's a lot of bets made and lost between the key players. There's a lot of the astrophysics community that doesn't believe they should have gotten the money, that doesn't think that they will ever succeed. Some of the experimentalists themselves, although incredibly proud of the technological achievement, are worried that nature will not provide sources. How do we know nature will provide things that ring space-time loud enough. We can't see black holes colliding with telescopes. Maybe there aren't hardly any out there. Maybe they'll never ring the instruments. So Ray says to me, you know, this very daring thing, that unless they detect black holes, this thing is a failure. In September 2015, it's September 13th, the weekend before the big event, and they don't even have the instrument in science mode yet. What that means is they're still running tests. They're still banging and hammering on the instrument. Ray's there studying radio interference. And finally, he says, luckily, my wife called me and said it's time to come home. So he gets on a plane and he goes to Maine. The middle of the night, Sunday to Monday, middle of the night, early morning Monday, a lot of the scientists, they're still banging on the machine in Louisiana. They're still hammering at the instrument in Washington, and they're running tests. They're trying to disturb it. And at around 4 a.m. Louisiana time, at around 2 a.m. Washington time, everyone gets tired and goes home. They just put their tools down. They're fed up. They go home. They leave the instrument in observing mode, and they call it a night. By 4:50 a.m., this gravitational wave that has been traveling from the collision of these two black holes has been traveling 1.3 billion years since the time that multi-celled organisms were fossilizing on the Earth. When Einstein first started theorizing about curved space-time and gravitational waves, they were in some near nebula outside our solar system. When they hit Neptune, the instrument still hadn't been fully assembled. Actually, that's not true. How far away is Neptune? I take it back. The instrument was fully assembled. It was probably hours away by then. And then, within an hour of them putting down their instruments, it comes from the southern sky, it hits the instrument in Louisiana, rings the machine, records the gravitational wave, and 7 milliseconds later, it travels across the continent and rings the machine in Hanford. By the time Ray wakes up, 8:30, something like that, in Maine, the gravitational wave is several billion light years away. And he wakes up and he looks at the logs and he thinks, you know, what the hell is that? There's a candidate event that the logs recorded, a candidate event. And that morning, everything erupts. People in Europe were up earlier. They were the first to see something in the log. And all the scientists, there's a lot of chatter. They start to get on the line to discuss amongst themselves what this was, what this detection might be. And everyone's incredulous. They all start accusing people of falsely injecting the signal. Not maliciously, but because there is an agreement that there's two people on the team of nearly 1,000 people that are allowed to falsely inject signals in the data. And as a test of the group and the experiment and the preparedness and the validity of the analysis and the integrity of the science. But it slowly dawns on Mike Landry, who's a lead scientist in Hanford, as he interrogates quite grumpily one of the people who has this privilege, that the answers are coming out strange, and he begins to realize, oh, this isn't a false injection. And he says he goes very cold, and he's on the line with maybe a couple hundred people on a telecon, and he blurts out, this was not a false injection. And he says, you know, somebody from Caltech pipes up, Mike, can you say that again? And from that moment forward, they realize they have a real candidate. And they spend the next couple of months analyzing the data and determining that they have recorded not only the first gravitational wave, which they told me, some of the experimentalists, was still 3 years off. They really didn't even expect it for another 3 years. Not only had they recorded finally the first gravitational wave sound, but they had recorded the first pair of black holes ever detected. And not only had they recorded the first pair of black holes ever detected, it was the most powerful event ever detected since the Big Bang. More power came out in complete darkness from the pure ringing of space-time than all the power shining from all the stars in the observable universe combined. And this was just a spectacular, stunning achievement. And so with that, hoping that that gives you more of a context and an understanding of what the discovery was and how thrilling it's been for someone like me to really be able to celebrate the achievements of my colleagues, which is just absolutely masterful. With that, I'd love to invite Tucker up if we could move into doing some questions and taking questions from the audience.
Jenna, Thank you for being here. This
Thank
is
you.
So
Thank
interesting.
Thank you for having me.
I have some of my own questions, and I'll get to, how about this? I'll offer you a wild one here first.
Okay.
Could we see an anti-gravity machine?
So anti-gravity, I think, would really just be gravity with the opposite sign. So here's how it works. We know that, you know about electromagnetism. You know that some magnets attract, and some, if you move them the other way, they repel. So that comes in both signs, attracting and repulsive. Gravity only comes in the attracting variety, meaning all the masses, since gravity has to do with two objects with mass, all masses are positive. They're all positive masses, and they all attract. If you had a negative mass, or so you might be able to get a repulsive gravitational force, something like that. So yes, we there are limits on this possibility. And what's the question? Could we observe it?
Was could that the we see? Could we develop perhaps an anti-gravity machine?
So it'd be pretty hard to develop something like that. As far as we know, the universe just doesn't provide things like that. But we might be able to mimic it. So we think that because gravity is attractive, that we think in this old Newtonian way, like two things coming together. But we understand from Einstein that there is a way to actually push things apart, even though gravity is attractive. I know it's quite confusing, but who's heard of dark energy? Okay, so dark energy is an example of a form of energy that drives the universe to stretch and expand. There are many forms of energy which do that, but dark energy is special because it causes the universe to expand faster and faster and faster, accelerate. And that has been a really stunning observation. So you can think that even though there isn't actually technically anti-gravity, there is a phenomenon where things get pushed apart because of the way that space and time responds to certain energies.
So antimatter would have opposite electric charge than normal matter, but it wouldn't fall up. There is no fabled
upsidazia.
No,
antimatter exists. Luckily, there's not a lot of it, because when it gets near matter, it annihilates matter and turns it into light. If the universe had equal parts matter and antimatter when it was formed, there'd be nothing in the universe but light. Okay, that all of it would come together and it would obliterate, it would annihilate and just create light. So luckily, for reasons unknown, actually, it's one of the fantastic questions in cosmology, there's a tiny bit more matter than antimatter created in the Big Bang. But antimatter is completely real. It has opposite electric charge and opposite quantum charges, but it has the same mass. So for an electron, there's a positron. The positron has exactly the same mass, and as you said, it doesn't fall up. It falls down, just like matter.
No upsidazium from the old Rocky Bullwinkle series. Oh, it's a shame. Let me ask you a question about LIGO's purpose. Mm-hmm. Most of us now, I imagine, think that it was intended to detect gravitational waves. But for some physicists, maybe some of us, was it also intended to further test Einstein's general relativity theory?
Well, so Einstein considered the existence of gravitational waves to be the most important question that he had to turn to as soon as he started to think about gravity as a curved space-time. So if you think of what Einstein suggested, he said, oh, here's the Earth. What's actually happening when the apple falls from the tree isn't that the Earth is pulling on it, because it's not touching it. What's happened is that the Earth has actually curved space and time around it in such a way that the apple is falling along the natural curves in space-time. It's a big idea. It's a big, grand idea. But if the Earth moves, those curves in space-time have to move also. And those, in some sense, are the gravitational waves. That as things are moving and sloshing around, the shapes around them have to move and adjust, and that creates waves, just like fish swirling in a pond. And so it's absolutely crucial in Einstein's approach to gravity that gravitational waves exist. It's absolutely crucial. So you could say, yes, LIGO has confirmed the correctness of Einstein's theory. But nobody's that surprised about that, because we've had incredible evidence that gravitational waves exist indirectly. There's a system known as the Hulse-Taylor pulsar, which is a neutron star which has a beam of light that it sweeps around like a lighthouse. It's called a pulsar, and you see it orbiting a companion, and you see it falling into the companion very, very, very slowly. It will take something like several hundred million years for it to finally fall in. But that the reason it's falling in is because it's emitting these gravitational waves, and that's siphoning energy out of the orbit, and it slowly spirals in. So the evidence indirectly has been there since the early 70s. I think the much more remarkable thing is to actually record it.
In the 100 years of the general theory of relativity's existence, has there been any evidence outside of the quantum realm, evidence that general relativity doesn't work?
No.
Yeah, it's a solid theory.
No, it's a really solid theory. It's doing really well. It's stunning. But outside the quantum realm was your caveat, and that's a big caveat because we know it doesn't work in the quantum realm. So general relativity is not the whole story because it does not coexist with quantum mechanics, and the two have to be made consistent because we know that there are regions like the cores of black holes which will call upon quantum scales and can't be ignored. Now, we can ignore it because we're safely behind, you know, we're outside the black hole. But if you were to fall in, there must be some reality about what's going on in the interior. And so there must be some quantum theory of gravity, and that we don't have.
Here's an audience member question. Mm-hmm. Does the study of gravitational waves have any implications on any theories of a multiverse?
That would be cool. but no, it's really a different... right now, it's a really different scale, meaning we're looking at large astrophysical objects, and information about the multiverse would probe, in some sense, quantum scales, ultimately. Now, it's possible that we haven't thought of everything, that maybe the multiverse will, the existence of a multiverse, and just in case people don't know what that means, it's literally the suggestion that our Big Bang is not a unique event. That when we look back 13.8 billion years and we see this hot primordial event that looks to us like the creation of the entire universe, it might only be the creation of our bubble in a much bigger structure where there are other universes which have had other Big Bangs. And ours is not only not the first, it's certainly not going to be the last. That's really the multiverse. Now, the problem is that these universes don't communicate with each other. And so it's very, very, very hard to think of any way whatsoever in which another universe could leave some record of its existence in ours. We don't know how to do that in any way, let alone in a way that could be read in the gravitational waves. Now, some people argue that we might learn enough about string theory or quantum gravity that we'll feel compelled to accept the multiverse without empirical evidence. But a lot of people don't like that either.
This next question comes from Rhea, a fifth grader with very good handwriting. Congratulations, Rhea.
Usually better than the adults, yeah.
Were there any radio or TV disturbances when the gravitational wave passed through?
I mean, it's a good question. We know that the light, surprisingly, shockingly actually, the light left over from the Big Bang, which was once incredibly hot, has been cooling for all of these years, these billions of years, and now the light is actually so cool, it's in the microwave range, which means that in the old-fashioned television sets with the bunny ears, about a certain percentage, small percentage, a few percent, of the static on your TV screen was due to the primordial light left over from the Big Bang. So it's really quite possible that astronomical phenomena can interfere with your television sets. I mean, digital television sets, not anymore. But no, the gravitational waves are so weak that we really needed to build these incredibly expensive, delicate instruments to get anywhere near detecting anything. If they had affected our TV sets, we'd be thrilled because we wouldn't have to build such an expensive machine.
Are black holes considered to be dark matter? There's a further follow-up, but but let's go with that.
That's really intriguing. Some people are trying to suggest that black holes could be dark matter. So there's a form of matter in the universe that makes up about 22%, 23% of the constituents of the universe. It's a large percentage. You have to realize that the ordinary matter, the matter from all the stars shining, all the galaxies that we can see, everything in your bodies, everything you know about in the entire world, makes up less than 5%. It's a bit of like ashy residue left over from the Big Bang. Most of it is in dark matter, and even more of it is in dark energy. 70-some percent is in dark energy. So could it be black holes? Could black holes be dark matter? I mean, after all, they don't reflect light. They don't emit light. They're dark. Technically, they are a form of dark matter. The problem is black holes are made, as far as we understand, from the collapse of stars. And stars are made of ordinary matter. So there's no way that we know of in the Big Bang to make such a huge percentage of ordinary matter to later convert to dark matter. So we're in a kind of bind. Now, some people have suggested, what if we get the black holes from something other than the collapse of stars? Maybe they're made primordially. Primordial black holes, those made in the very early universe, would be so small that they would evaporate very quickly. So Hawking is famous for saying that black holes actually evaporate through a quantum process. It turns out that the bigger the black hole, the slower the process. The smaller the black hole, the faster the process. So if you make little black holes, they evaporate very quickly. So the answer is that probably not is the answer. But, you know, people do still banter, you know, bandy around the idea.
I talked about a follow-up question. Mm-hmm. When two black holes collide, do they become one?
Yes. So these two black holes that collided formed a bigger black hole, about 60 times the mass of the sun. And you'll notice it's 62 times the mass of the sun. It's actually less than the sum of the original masses. So you might say, where did all that mass go? We all know E equals MC squared, right? It's the most famous equation of all time. That mass that was lost was converted into the energy of the gravitational waves. Something like 3.5 times the mass of the sun was lost into the gravitational waves. And that's a huge amount of energy. That's why it's such a powerful event. So the black hole that formed from the collision started out like bloppy, and there's a theorem, mathematical theorem, that says there's no way to maintain an imperfection on a black hole. Black holes are really quite extraordinary things. And so all the lumps have to sort of be shed away. It's called the ring down, and they ring away through the gravitational waves. And what remains is a perfectly shaped spinning black hole with zero imperfections on it, zero. And when you listen to the gravitational wave, it's very hard to hear if you actually listen to it, but if you look at the waveform, you can see the ring down. It's quite spectacular. When they first told me about the event, which was around in December, and they showed me the data, and I remember the first thing I was screamed was like, you can see it ring down to a black hole, one quiet black hole. And then the gravitational waves stop, and it goes quiet.
Did you get to hear it? Could you hear the...
You can't, actually. So there were people in the control room when the signal hit, and it's too fast to parse by the human ear. So what happens is these are emitting gravitational waves really for billions of years, but they're just too quiet for anything to detect, even LIGO, even the previous generation of LIGO. It's only in the final one-fifth of a second that the sound becomes loud enough that when it hits the instrument, it's recorded. And the human ear cannot parse something that's one-fifth of a second. It's just too fast. Mm-hmm. It's not that it wasn't loud enough. It's that it was too fast. So if you listen to the recording, you can go on YouTube and type chirp, black holes, LIGO, and you can listen to the recording. It sort of whoop, sweeps up like that. That's what it sounds like. It's kind of not what you expect from black holes, but that's what they sound like. And it's drastically slowed down so that you can hear it.
All right, one more question from the same person. What other types of energy, if any, emanate from those collisions, perhaps from the matter that's near the black holes during fall?
It's an important question. Every time there's a candidate event detected by the machine, it will trigger a network of partner telescopes to repoint. You know, it's this sort of fantastic idea that within a minute and a half or something, it has to notify this network of detectors, and these telescopes in orbit around the Earth will suddenly like repoint and try to look in that part of the sky. There is a real hope that many events will have luminous, through actual light, signatures as well. But the two black holes, as far as we understand, did not. There was no matter nearby. They were completely dark to telescopes. There was one telescope that said, oh, we saw some gamma rays coming from over there, but it hasn't really been widely accepted as coming from that region. So it's more likely if a black hole collides with a neutron star, because a neutron star is a dead star that didn't quite make it to becoming a black hole, and it's made of real stuff. It's got a crust, and it's made of dense nuclear material, and if that goes near a black hole, then we expect you could crush it, you could rip it up, and that stuff would be luminous. So the answer is, for other systems, we very strongly hope that there will be very bright counterparts.
Excellent. In your solo presentation, you mentioned the names of three prominent figures, prominent mm-hmm. within the LIGO community. Mm-hmm. Is it just a coincidence that Nobel Prizes can only be awarded to at most three people?
It's not a coincidence at all. They were actually called the Troika. And although just casually, and they sort of argue about when that name started to come about. And this was well before there was any evidence that they would even build the actual machines, let alone succeed at it. I think the problem is there were many other people involved with making this succeed. Barry Barish is widely considered the best manager of large scientific projects in the world. And, you know, Barry was crucial in terms of driving LIGO towards success, managing the project, taking over from the Troika. The Troika couldn't make any decisions. Ray said to me, you know, we had all of this technology, we had all of this science, all of this ingenuity, but the three of us, him, Kip Thorne, and Ron Drever, couldn't agree on anything. He said, we made zero decisions. Kip said to me, you know, that's really not true. It's quite an exaggeration. And then he paused and he said, it's not much of an exaggeration. And eventually, Ron Drever was fired from the project, which was devastating for him personally. He was a Scottish physicist who came from a very different culture, kind of a odd but interesting guy, ingenious guy. And, you know, I think that there was this sense in which people like Barry would want to be included in the acknowledgement of this big success, and also people like Robbie Vogt, and who was the original director after the Troika kind of fell apart. But no, the Nobel Prize cannot go to five people. So it will be the Troika, probably. I mean, I don't want to get in trouble with Barry. He's a very intimidating guy.
Is there any doubt that this discovery is Nobel-worthy?
There's no doubt that this discovery is Nobel-worthy. Great. You know, there are people who say, look, why hasn't Vera Rubin won the Nobel Prize for her discovery of dark matter? And the dark energy guys got their Nobel Prize within a couple of years of their discovery. It's crazy. And Vera Rubin's been waiting for decades. So, and she's also in her 80s. So there are some people who are like, there might be a line. But a lot of people think they'll get it probably this year. But we'll see. I mean, you know, these things are unpredictable. Just to clarify, the Troika has won every major astronomical prize, and these are huge, huge prizes in the past year.
Can you tell us a little bit about someone who has done great work in the field, but you describe in your book as somebody who has, let me get it right here, is defined by significant near misses. Joe Weber.
Oh, yeah. Joe Weber is a beautiful, important figure in the field. Joe Weber was one of the original inventors of the concept of the maser, which we now consider the predecessor to the laser. He might well have shared the Nobel Prize for that discovery had certain things gone differently. He tried to strike out to do microwave astronomy. Had things gone differently for him there, he might have discovered the light left over from the Big Bang. And then he became the pioneer of gravitational wave astronomy in the 50s when nobody was doing this because people didn't even think this was real. Even Einstein was, you know, people were confused about whether gravitational waves were real. Einstein kept changing his mind. They're real, they're not real. He was, by the late 30s, he was still saying, I don't know. So Weber thought, oh, leave these theorists to their pen and paper. I'm going to go outside and have a look around, you know. And he built this instrument, which was an aluminum bar. It was basically a tuning fork. And the idea was that if a gravitational wave passed at the right frequency, it would ring the tuning fork, and you could detect the gravitational waves. And his tuning fork was ringing like mad. And he took him about 10 years. He did it very much on his own. And he became one of the most famous physicists alive. He was celebrated. Within 2 years, there were literally Weber bars everywhere, Japan, Germany, Russia.
Were people went for drinks, that kind of Weber bar?
Physicists are not known for their drinking. You know, they get thrown out of Las Vegas because they don't drink anything. And they don't gamble. Sort of a funny bunch. So the skies were quiet for everybody else. So Weber, in the span of 2 years, goes from being the most famous physicist alive to being ostracized from the physics community. He's treated very badly and very aggressively, but he won't relent. He's sure he's detecting something, and everyone's sure that he's not. And it becomes a very sad and tragic battle for the next couple of decades.
You mentioned in your book about some data that Joe Weber presents at a big conference that cites the 24-hour cycle of the passage of the center of the Milky Way overhead, causing an increase in the gravitational wave that's detectable. Mm-hmm. But I guess at that moment, very few people point out that gravitational waves go through the Earth. Mm-hmm. And so the periodicity should be every 12 hours, not every 24 hours.
Right. So he thought that the gravitational waves that were ringing the bar were coming from the center of the galaxy, which is a reasonable supposition. It's a very dense part of the galaxy. We now know that there's tens of thousands of black holes, tens of thousands, orbiting a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. It's completely sensible to expect that that would be a region where there'd be a lot of gravitational waves coming from that. So he looked at his data, and he did see a correlation that every time the center of the galaxy was overhead, his bars were ringing. But he failed to realize that they should also be ringing when the galaxy is below, because the Earth causes no impediment to the gravitational waves ringing his instrument. So when people pointed this out, you know, Joe, if this is right, then your instrument should be ringing every 12 hours, not every 24 hours. And he came back 2 weeks later with them ringing every 12 hours. So there was a lot of, I don't think he was lying. I think something was going wrong in his statistical analysis, where he could pull out patterns from anything, from just pure noise.
We are good at seeing patterns in the noise.
That's right. We see a man on the moon. You know, it doesn't mean that there's a man on the moon.
This is a lesson that's true in all of science. You mentioned noise being important in almost every experiment. Is it especially so in LIGO?
Yeah, noise has a special... Noise is a term in any experiment that means your uncertainty. That's all it really means. It doesn't actually mean sound noise. It just means your uncertainty. In LIGO, it actually means noise. So if you listen to the detector in the control room, as the experimentalists do, you hear noise. It sort of goes... And you can hear different details in the noise. You can hear the sort of whooshing from some modes. And the noise that you're hearing is every rumble of the Earth, an earthquake in China, winds off the Gulf, planes overhead, the sun and the moon pulling and stretching. So it is exactly the problem. It is why LIGO can never be infinitely precise. Right now the instrument's down and it's going to upgrade to be a little more sensitive at high frequencies, at higher notes, but it will only reach for a factor of 3 more sensitive. It can't go 100 or 1,000 times. That's just a physical impossibility, and the limitation is the noise.
How often can we expect to detect gravitational waves?
Well, this is why, if you even asked Kip, you know, I would ask him. I mean, they had already reached an incredible technological achievement even before anything was detected, and that was admirable. But if you asked him, are you sure you're going to record something, Kip would say, of course I'm not sure. You know, how do I know what nature is going to provide? I mean, they have estimates, but if you're really looking for something completely new, we have no idea how many black hole pairs are out there. And so many people told me black holes will be last. Kip was the only one who said, I think black holes will be first. And he thought they'd be first because they can get bigger and bigger and louder and louder, and that means we can hear them from further and further away. And he thought that would give black holes an advantage. But it would have been completely possible, from what we knew of at the time, that maybe nature just wouldn't comply, wouldn't give this to us often. We now think from, there's a second detection that was announced, by the way, just about a week ago. It actually struck the machines on Boxing Day, December 26th, 2015. And it's not quite as loud as the first event, but it's a pretty beautiful event. It looks like one black hole was about 15 times the mass of the sun. One was about 7.5 times the mass of the sun. It was also quite distant, over a billion light years away. And that event, plus the first event, plus some other hints, suggest that it will happen quite often that we'll hear these things. The amazing thing is it's only been black holes so far.
So the fact that LIGO got a signal, essentially as soon as the switch went on, is, I want to say that's supremely lucky, but it really isn't given how long they had been building up to this
process.
That's
right. Yeah.
But how about your writing of this book?
Yeah, my writing of the book
what
was
good fortune
very
was
lucky.
That?
Yeah. Yeah. It was excellently good fortune that I was 2 years late on the delivery of my book.
Oh,
so I dovetailed perfectly with the experiment. And I was 2 years late because I set out to write one book and I had to admit to myself I was writing a different book. That was painful for me. And I don't know if there are writers in the audience, but you know, you have to fight yourself sometimes and you have to let go of your expectations. And it's a lot like science. And you have a theory, you start to follow your conjecture and you realize you're wrong and that you have to take a left turn and follow the evidence. And this is kind of what it was like for writing the book. I went that way and I realized I had to go this way. So it turned out to be perfect confluence because I became so close with the experimentalists that I knew that they had installed the components and everything was locked. And it was sort of in August, I was thinking, you know, it's time to wrap up. So I mean, coincidentally, on the day of the detection, I printed first drafts of the book, one copy for Ray and one copy for Kip. So they wow. got those copies probably the next day. And they were the first two to read the book.
And the description in your book of the detection is in an epilogue, right? It was so that was an after the fact.
Yeah,
edition.
I mean, I very much was so happy to be able to write the book with the suspense of not knowing. I could not have tricked myself into writing the book with that suspense if I had already known. I did find out the book wasn't supposed to be published until August of this year, so not for another couple of months. So I could have rewritten the whole book with the detection, but it just would have ruined it. I mean, the book was about the risk and the turmoil and the difficulty of the campaign and what makes people follow their curiosity at all costs, personal cost, professional cost. And so rewriting it would have to my mind, ruined it completely. But I am so, so happy to have that epilogue. It's really quite a sweet close.
You mentioned the three individuals and mm-hmm. several wagers that passed among them and others.
Mm-hmm.
Could you mind telling us a story about any wagers regarding the detection of gravitational waves? And because somebody probably made some money and lost some money on September 14th, 2015.
These guys were always betting inappropriate magazines and things like that. Usually cases of wine and penthouse were involved in most of the wagers. Let's see, there's one of the famous bets was between Kip Thorne and Jerry Ostreicher. Jerry Ostreicher is a very well-known, very admired astrophysicist from Princeton. He's now at Columbia. And Kip wagered that they would detect gravitational waves by the turn of the century. And Jerry wagered against, and Jerry was one of the very vocal people who thought that LIGO would never succeed, although he's very pleased now with their success, and he's very generous about it, but he was sore that it cost so much money. Mm. And he was quite unhappy that it had such a big budget. It was the most expensive project funded by the National Science Foundation, and it was the most expensive project ever to come out of Caltech. So these were major markers. Kip lost the bet. The machines weren't even built until 2000. So he clean out lost that bet. And he owed Jerry a case of wine. Jerry was taunting that Kip took a while to pay, and you know, Kip brags that he's won every bet he's ever made that doesn't have a date on it. And then as soon as he makes a mistake of putting a date on it, then he doesn't win the bet. But he did concede. Kip Kip remembers it quite differently. He did concede, and he sent them a case of wine, and he has a nice note from Jerry as they were toasting, you know, to the future of LIGO.
You've mentioned dreams of Turing machines and Ray's dreams of LIGO. Mm. What dreams, either aspirations or nocturnal visions, have you had on the subject of physics?
Yeah, I weirdly love physics. It's hard to describe. I was not the kid with the chemistry set in the basement. I did not learn physics in high school. I know you taught physics in high school. I never took physics in high school. I had no physics until about halfway through college. I thought that, and this happens a lot, you can talk to a lot of people and they will say they wanted to be creative. And I did not think physics was creative. I thought it was about memorizing equations and facts. And I just didn't know. I just didn't know. It was this terrible thing. And I wanted to be a creative person. It was about halfway through college that something broke through this stereotype I had. And I suddenly realized that this was this magnificent form of creativity within this incredible scaffolding of the constraints of physics. And I think that's what all creativity is. All creativity is within rigid constraints, that all great artists impose rigid constraints on their work, and all great writers impose rigid constraints. And it's only once those decisions have locked in that you're really free. And if you think about the history of physics, profound constraints have led to creative revolutions. You know, Einstein was the first one to accept the constraint of the speed of light. That was his first step, was to concede that the speed of light was a rigid constraint, where all of his colleagues were trying to get rid of the constraint. He accepts it, and from that, he uses it like this pole vault to create relativity theory. And now we have black holes and the Big Bang and an expanding universe. I mean, the world is much more revolutionary for it. Other examples are in quantum mechanics. The limit of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle led to the quantum revolution, where we discovered the world was much stranger and extraordinary than we could have imagined if we hadn't accepted the constraint. And Turing was another example where he accepted the constraint that there are facts that we can never know in mathematics, which was a shocking limitation. And from it, he invents the concept of the computer and artificial intelligence. So why did I go on this long spiel? When I realized that physics was this creative endeavor, this incredibly creative endeavor within the constraint, and I saw it that way, I think that that's been my lifelong campaign, to sort of get cleaner and tighter and more minimalist, and within it, you know, kind of unlock the walnut as much as possible.
Jana's book is full of evidence of creativity, her own, and in her writing and also in the quotations she's chosen. She did not ask me to say this. I'm not shilling for this book, but I'd like to read you a quotation.
I'll give you money later.
A quotation attributed to John Wheeler, the man who revived the study of general relativity in America. He says, and he's dead now. He died in about 10 years ago in his late 90s. But he said, "Now in my 80s, I am still searching. Yet I know the pursuit of science is more than the pursuit of understanding. It is driven by the creative urge, the urge to construct a vision, a map, a picture of the world that gives the world a little more beauty and coherence than it had before."
It's a great quote.
It should be in a book somewhere.
Yeah, it's in Wheeler's book and mine.
Beautiful.
And mine. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful way of saying it. And of course, Wheeler was the man who coined the term black hole. And he was very influential. He was the American father of relativity. He taught all the relativists, including Kip. Kip was one of his young students.
A few days ago, I wrote to Jana asking her about what questions I might pose. And she emphasized, as the book does, the importance of the people that built these remarkable machines. Here's a passage from a book that I hope gets some of that across. "There's an important pursuit of objectivity in science and mathematics, but still the only way up the wall of science understanding, is through the individual people And they come in specifics. The French guy, the German guy, the American girl. So the climb is personal, a truly human endeavor. And the real expedition pixelates into individuals, not into platonic forms. As much as we want to believe it's objective, in the end, it's personal. Did it get that way when you were writing the book? And I imagine, Did that take over? Your urge to explain things seems to have been at least supplemented heavily by your urge to understand the people.
Yeah, when I realized I was writing this book, I realized I was writing it more like a novel than like a science book. And that came because of my relationship with Ray more than anything else. That listening to Ray talk, he has this great accent. You know, it's sort of an amalgam of New York accents from that era of immigrants. He was originally born in Germany and grew up afterwards in New York. And the way he spoke, I thought, I can't break this. He said things to me like that were just the phrasing and everything was so perfect. I thought Ray is a character in a novel, and these are his lines. Now you have to understand, I have days of tape with Ray. Days, okay. So and Ray's a good talker. So there might be one line out of 2 hours of tape. Right, that becomes the character's lines. But you know, it really for me started to work that way. He's the one who gave me the hope that the book could be written this way. And if you think about novels, there's really no reason why science can't be the expedition around which the book is structured.
Another line from your book, quote, maybe the sonic universe, that is, the universe of gravitational waves, will be as beautiful as the visible universe. Are there astrophysical phenomena we have not even imagined yet? Can we hear dark matter, dark energy, dark dimensions? So you really do see this as an opening of our eyes, as Maxwell opened our eyes to the full electromagnetic spectrum. LIGO may be taking us to an entirely different spectrum altogether.
Yeah, that's right. Kip always said when I was sort of growing up in grad school, I would listen to the famous Kip Thorne, and he would talk about the new window, you know, that this would be like the invention of the telescope. This would be something completely other. I don't think I fully felt that until more recently, when we do realize that 95% of the universe is dark. And it's hard to think of ways for dark matter and dark energy to ring space-time. It's not going to be easy, but none of it's really easy. And, the history of physics and astronomy hasn't been easy. It's been glorious, but it hasn't been easy. And so, yes, maybe it will fizzle out and all we'll hear is a few black holes and that will be the end. Or maybe what we'll really have is a soundtrack to go along with this silent movie.
Seems we have time for just one more question, and it's something that can involve all of us, not immediately, but very soon. Can you tell us a little bit about Einstein at home? Does that ring a bell?
No.
Oh, okay. That wasn't a setup.
What are you talking about?
I thought Einstein at Home was a project at LIGO to incorporate citizen scientists and helping to analyze data.
Yeah,
does that ring a bell?
I didn't know it had that cute name.
Maybe it doesn't.
I don't know that much about the project, but there is that sounds right. Is this where they want people to use their CPUs to analyze data?
Yeah, sorry.
So I've been with the project so long that sometimes I haven't caught up to when it has. I should emphasize I'm not actually in the collaboration. So I'm technically outside the collaboration. I'm just considered a good friend of the experiment. There have been other examples of this where people on their home computers can use them to look for galaxies and identify morphologies of galaxies. And the Galaxy Zoo was one of the most successful original attempts to do this to get, it's called citizen science, to get people to participate in the identification of sources. And so because LIGO is so computationally expensive, that because the noise is so loud, you have to search the noise It's like listening for your friend's voice in a really crowded cocktail bar. You have to write algorithms that know what your friend's voice sounds like. So they have to be able to pluck out the astrophysical source from the noisy room. And that requires a really intensive computational resources, much more than we have access to. So one of the ideas is if we involve citizens in the analysis, that they can use their own computers, and the computers will run the algorithms and will search for the signals.
I'm going to do it.
Yeah, excellent.
I hope you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and by Wonderfest. Again, we would like to thank our audience here in Palo Alto, those of you joining us on the radio, and of course, Professor Jana Levin, author of Black Hole Blues and other songs from outer space. And now, this meeting is adjourned.